Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWIL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 6 for May 4th, 2007, E-Commerce and Internet Law.
Hello and welcome to This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell, your host. And with me today are four wonderful panelists to talk about current issues in law and technology. On the line with me now are Kathy Kirkman, a partner at Wilson Sonsini Goodrich & Rosati in Palo Alto. Kathy, welcome to the show.
Hi, Denise. Glad to be here.
John Palfrey, the executive director of the Berkman Center at Harvard Law School and a founder of Top 10 Media. John, nice to have you.
Thanks, Denise.
Marty Schwimmer of the Schwimmer Law Firm. Marty, is that the correct name of your firm?
Schwimmer Mitchell Law Firm.
The Schwimmer Mitchell Law Firm in New York is joining us pinch hitting for our regular panelist, Ernie Svensson. Great to have you, Marty. Thanks for being on.
Thanks, Denise.
And joining us as our special guest this week is Ian Ballin, a partner at Greenberg Traurig in Los Angeles, who is a very well-known author and expert on internet and e-commerce law. In fact, he has a very widely referenced treatise called E-Commerce and Internet Law. I believe probably all of us on the line have referred to your treatise at one point or another. Ian, great to have you.
Thank you. Appreciate the kind introduction.
So Marty emailed me before the show with a note to have a moment of recognition for the passing of Ahmet Ertegun, if I'm saying that right, one of the co-founders of Atlantic Records, who died at the age of 83 yesterday. Marty, you want to expand on Ahmet and his contributions for us?
Well, he died today, I believe, at the age of 83. He was, as Denise noted, the founder of Atlantic Records. He was portrayed in several movies, most recently the biopic of Ray Charles' story. If you've ever loved anything on the Atlantic label, which would be Ray Charles or Mingus or Rolling Stones, then you've probably loved a record that he had something to do with. And for those of you with some time to spend today, look at the Wikipedia bio of Ahmet Ertegun. And remember that there are some people in the record industry who did it for the love of music, and we should just give them a silent note of thanks.
Hear, hear. And Marty's point in his email to me was that there are good folks, and as is sometimes lost in the shuffle, in the world of the web and blogging and podcasting, that there are good folks on the entertainment industry side of the equation, and that's something that I wanted to talk about a bit with Ian, who's in the unique role of being both a technology and entertainment lawyer, if I have that right. Ian, do you consider yourself in both camps?
Well, that's right. I mean, as you know, I work out of offices both in Palo Alto and in L.A., and I represent technology companies ranging from traditional software companies to internet companies like eBay and MySpace to entertainment companies like Fox and Sony Pictures. So I think I do cover both traditional entertainment and traditional technology in my practice.
I moderated a panel about a year ago where Kathleen Sullivan and some other luminaries were talking about the Grokster case. Kathleen Sullivan is the former dean of Stanford Law School and a really wonderfully bright and articulate woman.
And former faculty at the Harvard Law School.
Oh, that's right. And she characterized the sort of technology entertainment law divide in a way on our panel that I hadn't heard before, and that was sort of Northern California versus Southern California. So it's interesting, Ian, that you have offices in both places and represent both kinds of clients. Do you ever find yourself having cognitive dissonance or other sort of strange phenomenon based on the fact that, you know, at some times you are wearing your tech lawyer hat and at other times your entertainment industry lawyer hat?
I really don't. You know, I think the Supreme Court noted in the Grokster case that that there really isn't as much of a divide between entertainment and technology as the press likes to focus on. There certainly is a divide between companies whose business models depend on infringement and companies whose business models depend on copyright protection. But I think the number of technology companies whose business models today really depend on massive infringement is pretty small. And the reality is, if you look at tech companies like Apple, like MySpace, like any number of tech companies, they are also entertainment companies. And similarly, if you start looking at what entertainment companies do, a lot of what they do involves technology. So I think the hype about the divide is perhaps overplayed a bit.
I was going to mention that Ian is one of the hippest lawyers on MySpace, and MySpace is actually your client, is that right?
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm not sure if I'm the hippest lawyer, I'm not sure, but I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I appreciate the compliment anyway.
Well, I had great fun checking out your MySpace profile when you first sent it to me, and I guarantee you, you are one of the hippest lawyers on MySpace. I mean, I think you had just thrown a party, and you had people who were checking in going, woo, Ian, great bash, and some very interesting-looking friends added there, and not being on MySpace myself, it is somewhat of a mystery to me still, but and I did want to ask you, is there a reason why the profile is no longer public?
Well, not any particular reason. I do think that with 135 million members, it's a very unique community. And I think if you look at companies like MySpace, like YouTube, like Grouper, you see a lot of very interesting opportunities for people to interact in new and different ways. And frankly, this time, late 2006, reminds me quite a bit of about 11 years ago, late 1995, when everyone was rushing onto the internet, but there was still a certain newness and excitement associated with the medium. And I think we see that with social networking and with video blogging and the opportunity for people to express themselves in new and interesting ways.
Have you been involved in technology and internet law ever since you graduated law school in 1986?
Well, back in 1986, the internet really was not widely used. Certainly, I wasn't using it. At that time, it was primarily used by researchers and the Department of Defense. But, you know, being in Silicon Valley at the right time and I guess the right place in the early to mid-1990s, a lot of my traditional software copyright clients suddenly started having internet-related questions and issues, and my practice just naturally transitioned by the mid-1990s more to an internet practice from what previously was a more traditional computer law practice.
So basically, as soon as there was a browser, you were right there grappling with those issues?
Well, I think I was fortunate to be at the right place at the right time, and one of the things that was a catalyst to me writing my treatise was in 1995 I was asked to speak at the ABA convention on internet law, and in connection with that I put together an outline of internet law issues, and those were the days when you could get on Lexis and search for internet or email or World Wide Web or about five other terms and still come up with a fairly discrete number of items. I believe it was about a dozen cases and not many more law review articles. And because of that, Ray Ocampo, who at that time was the general counsel of Oracle, talked me into writing a book with him, which we envisioned to be about a 100-page primer. But because he's a much smarter man than I am, after convincing me that we could do it and after getting the contract with the publisher, he both pulled out and then convinced me that I could do it myself. So I think also having that opportunity put me in a position where I ended up focusing even more heavily on internet law early on.
Ian, can I interrupt with a question?
Sure.
You know, there are skeptics like Judge Posner who say there's no such thing as internet law, that it's not a natural way of categorizing it. And he says in a famous lecture, makes about as much sense as saying that there's the law of the horse. How would you define internet law to rebut such a concept?
Well, I mean, I think there's some truth to Judge Posner's observation. At the same time, if I were getting into the horse racing business, I would certainly want to hire a lawyer from Kentucky or someone who had experience in the area. And I think the same holds true for internet law. In many respects, internet law is just the law of many different disciplines applied to conduct online. There are some things that certainly are unique. There are a whole range of causes of action that have no corollaries in the physical world. If you look at spoofing, spamming, linking, framing, domain name disputes, these are all problems that arise uniquely on the Internet. On the other hand, there are many issues that are really just physical world disciplines that perhaps have a particular twist when applied to the Internet. I think Judge Posner is correct, though, in the sense that sometimes people, including judges, focus too much on the Internet aspect of a particular dispute. I think we saw that very early on in the development of the law governing personal jurisdiction, where I think judges were too apt to look at other Internet decisions rather than Supreme Court precedent on what constitutes minimum contact. And I think sometimes we see that, where a dispute that arises on the Internet may cause a judge or a lawyer or a commentator to look very closely at a poorly reasoned decision that deals with an analogous problem on the Internet rather than looking to much better reasoned physical world precedent. So, in some ways I agree with Judge Posner, in some ways I disagree. What's your thought?
Everything you just said, completely. Particularly struck with what you just said about people who get carried away and look only to Internet precedents. Are there any fields of any cases or doctrines right now where you feel things are not developing as nicely as you'd like to see them because people are getting carried away?
I'm not sure that things aren't necessarily developing as nicely, but I think as a general proposition, I'm a fan of the common law. I think over time, the courts tend to iron out problems. You know, at any moment in time, you can look at an issue and be concerned about the way it's resolved. I think certainly if you look at the split of authority right now among courts in the area of Internet advertising, you can say that right now the law is unclear and there are certain incentives created to forum shopping. I'm not sure that that's a defect, though. I think it's just that the common law takes a while to iron out differences and eventually a general principle emerges.
Actually, I could dominate something where people got carried away by bad analogies, and that would be initial interest confusion doctrine in trademark law, where we have what I thought was a tortuous analogy in the movie bus case in the Ninth Circuit, where someone analogized misleading use of tags on the Internet with getting off the wrong exit on the highway and not bothering to get back on and not realizing that the switching costs in the Internet is only as easy as hitting the back button. So I think that would be a good example where a real-world analogy was poorly used for an Internet application.
Well, I think more broadly, sometimes judges strain to find physical world analogies, and those are often ill-suited. I mean, even the Supreme Court, for example, going back in the pre-Internet days, in the oral argument for Lotus Borland, when the Supreme Court tried to grapple with whether the command structure hierarchy of a software program is like an elevator in a department store, or in the Internet context, in the New York Times v. Ticini case, where the question was whether a database like LexisNexis has the feel of the morning newspaper. I think whenever judges try to find analogies, it's often very difficult. And I understand why judges do that, but oftentimes the analogies are not perfect.
Well, one area where it's difficult to find a whole lot of non-internet analogies, because the law was designed to cope with the internet, is the DMCA. And this is something that is coming more and more to a head in recent suits filed against companies like your client MySpace, Ian, and your other client Grouper, and various online video sharing sites, in that the DMCA's safe harbor, which traditionally has been used for other sorts of online service providers, might well be the justification, or one of the justifications, for going forward with the business models that are being challenged now in those two suits by Universal Music Group and other suits coming down the pipe. Before you go ahead and chime in on that, I do want to mention, and we've dealt with this on the podcast before with respect to Kathy, and all of us are practicing lawyers in one way or another, except for perhaps John. John, do you still represent clients, or?
Sure. Through our clinical program, I do, and I'm a member of two bars and keep them active.
Right, exactly. So all of us, I do want to mention for our audience, are under ethical restrictions regarding what we can and cannot say about our own clients and clients of our firms. And lawyers sometimes get a bad rap, I think, for being too closed-mouthed about things. And one of the things I think is great about this show and why I enjoy doing it is because people do come and talk in a very public way about important issues of the day. But there are limits to what you can do, and it's not because the person wants to be sneaky or closed-mouthed about anything. It's just that, you know, we're in this to help our clients, and these ethical rules exist so that we can do that. And so with that long-winded sort of preamble, I wanted to ask Ian about his take on the DMCA's role, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act's role, and its safe harbor provision in protecting some of these newer business models that are being challenged on a copyright infringement basis.
Sure, and I appreciate that preamble, because, of course, anything I say just reflects my own view and doesn't represent the views of my clients. And as you did mention, I do represent Grouper in one of those lawsuits. I think the DMCA does cover these business models. The question is whether an individual company is entitled to DMCA protection, or whether DMCA protection is available for particular transactions. Certainly, in the Grouper case, I mean, our answer speaks for itself, and in the answer, we do make it very clear that we believe that this case is fully covered by the DMCA. I think if you look at the DMCA, Congress deliberately made the provisions very broad, and it represented a compromise between the interests of copyright owners and the interests of service providers, and by and large, it's worked pretty well. I mean, the one thing that I saw after the passage of the DMCA is that the volume of copyright infringement litigation dropped dramatically against service providers. Copyright owners, instead of having to pay someone like me or the other folks on the line to go into court and get an injunction, could, for very little money, put together a notification, send it to a service provider, and get the material removed. Similarly, service providers, instead of having to pay someone like us to go into court and defend them, could avoid any of that cost or expense simply by disabling access to or removing the offending material. And by and large, the DMCA works extremely well. So I think that it absolutely has application to the new kinds of services that we're seeing on the internet. And frankly, although technology has changed, and although the way people interact online has changed, the legal issues in this area, I think, have remained fairly constant. And any legitimate company that wants to set up a service like this can comply with the DMCA and thereby limit their liability.
Does it give you pause at all that we're talking now about a service that is not just providing email or, you know, the ability to access the internet, but is something more, is more content-based itself, and specifically in the online video model is incorporating, in all likelihood, various kinds of advertising.
Well, I think if you go back to 1998 when the DMCA was passed, the examples that people had in mind when they were negotiating the provisions that ultimately were enacted into law involved AOL, where individual users could post material on their personal homepages or could transmit material over email. And although the technology today is a lot cooler and the processor speeds are faster and the bandwidth is connections are better, to a large extent the legal issues are really the same. And the issues come down to whether a particular service is built on infringement or whether it's a legitimate service that's intended to promote user content and one that complies with the DMCA.
Well, Ian, what about the vast economic impact of the shift that we're seeing take place from traditional consumption of entertainment to non-traditional both means of consumption and types of things that are being consumed, much more micro-content, much more user-generated material. Do you see that playing into the whole DMCA analysis when this comes to a head in court?
I personally don't. I think that the business trends are interesting and they're fascinating. And there certainly are new opportunities created by new technology. I think there's also a place for traditional entertainment. I certainly like the experience of seeing a motion picture in the theater, and I think a lot of people do as well. But I think the legal issues are really very much the same, even though the technology and the business models have changed over time.
Do you see a shift, because I think I do, in the ways that people are consuming media that traditionally have been the province of the television screen, for example, music videos? If I were to want to view a music video now, I don't think I would think for a second to look for it on TV. You know, I'm sort of a unique, more internet-drenched person than most of your average computer users out there maybe, but you know, I think more and more that's taking place. And do you think that, I guess it goes back to our questions at the top of the show about the tension between the entertainment and the technology industry. Do you think the entertainment industry is prepared to grapple with those kinds of shifts and is grappling with them in an appropriate way?
Well, I love music videos, and I love the fact that you can buy them and download them to your iPod. I don't see that as inconsistent with anything we've been discussing. I think that there are new and interesting business models emerging. But I, from a legal standpoint, I've yet to see that really has any real meaningful impact on the DMCA.
John, what are your thoughts about the safe harbor and how it's going to play out in these video sharing suits?
Well, I think I share the view of those who suspect that the DMCA will play a huge role in the video sharing suits and ought, anyway, to cover much of the activity of the intermediaries in this zone. I think there are a few outstanding questions in terms of how the safe harbor will apply to certain activities. One outstanding question, I think, is how much of an affirmative obligation will there be on the sharing sites to filter out content that one might reasonably believe to be infringing. I think a related question is whether or not if there's knowledge generally of the presence of infringing material in the system, but not specific knowledge about an individual file, does that undercut somehow the safe harbor? Another question being, what does it mean to derive financial benefit directly from infringement? So I think that, as you noted, Denise, when you framed the question a few minutes ago, the Act was not created with this exact scenario in mind. 8 years ago, the sort of paradigmatic case was probably a GeoCities page or a much flatter, less dynamic kind of situation. And I think that the what the law actually means in this context is going to be tested. But I do think it ought to apply to the most well-meaning of the video sharing sites.
Ian, this is Kathy. I have a question for you. So, when in the case that you're defending, are there inducement claims? And you know, what's your view on inducement? You know, vis-a-vis the DMCA.
And we should just clarify background-wise for our listeners that inducement claims are how someone could be liable for a third party's copyright infringement.
That was the whole Grokster thing. Sorry, Denise. And Ian, of course, if you don't want to speak to your case, I just raised the point to get your view.
Well, I think it's one thing to allege inducement, which is pretty easy under the very liberal pleading standards in federal court. Anyone can make that allegation. I don't think inducement has any role in the case that I'm defending.
Kathy, are you seeing it come up regularly in the cases that you're advising on?
No, I'm just wondering if you have thought about how the two relate to each other, and whether, since you represent content owners, whether you say the DMCA sort of works well, whether you have situations where you have found that you're not happy with how a website is treating your client's content.
Yeah, I think we've made very clear in our answer that inducement has no part of this case, and that the case is plainly and fully covered by the DMCA.
Well, I, for one, am really looking forward to see how all of that plays out in the next several months to years, depending on the speed of the judicial system. One interesting thing that caught my eye is the selection of judge in your case, Ian, the UMG versus MySpace case. It's the same judge, is it not, that was the trial court judge in Grokster?
Well, my case is Grouper, and the cases against Grouper and Bolt have been low-numbered to Judge Matz. I believe the MySpace case is likely to be low-numbered there as well, which is just the procedure. The way things work in the Central District of California, if there are related cases, they get assigned to the court where the first case was assigned. So in this instance, it seems likely that all of the cases would go before Judge Matz, who was not the lower court judge in Grokster.
I'm sorry, my mistake there. I thought you had both those pieces of litigation as they grind their way forward. But they definitely, I think, will be milestones, because the DMCA didn't exist when the Napster case wound its way through the courts and just recently came to yet another partial conclusion with the settlement with Hummer Winblad. Did you guys see that had happened?
Yeah, I did, although just a point of clarification. The DMCA was passed in 1998, and the Napster case was filed in 99. And in 2000, the Judge Patel ruled that Napster was not entitled to DMCA protection.
So despite Mr. Boyce's attempts to make it so, right?
Pardon me?
It was argued, in fact, that the DMCA applied by the Napster defense, didn't it?
They did make that argument, the court ruled that it was not applicable in that case, I think on well-founded grounds.
So the
why doesn't
they
that
looked
apply?
I think the decision was about 512A, right, which was the ISP provision. And I think David Nimmer has an article saying he thinks it should have been covered by another safe harbor. And in the litigation back and forth in the investor case, I think it was raised that they felt that was not completely adjudicated. So I thought that was an interesting thread hanging out there about Napster.
It is interesting. I mean, Napster, of course, was a very different kind of service than any of the ones that are in litigation today, and it was a business model that was built entirely on third-party infringement. And there were lots of internal documents that showed that the people who formed the company initially knew full well that it would be used for infringement and hoped to monetize it. And frankly, in the go-go years of the internet boom, expected that if they developed an interesting enough business model, they'd be able to make it legitimate eventually. And that, of course, is dramatically different from any of the legitimate services that we see in operation today.
So, Ian, just as a functional matter, why isn't the strongest argument against the video sharing sites that it's just the Napster scenario, absent, as you noted, the sort of clear inducement problem, but it's just the Napster scenario, only, in fact, better ability to find a file that you want or a video that you want? What's the difference in the reasoning between the current cases and the Napster reasoning?
Well, I mean, there are lots of differences, and as you can appreciate, I'm just not comfortable addressing those in a public forum. But I will say that the sites are almost completely different. Napster, Aimster, and indeed even Grokster were all services where almost all of the files were infringing, and you really had to strain to find any unauthorized material, and those were all businesses that were built solidly on infringement. I think that that's very, very different from a business that's built solidly for legitimate purposes, where you really have to strain to find anything that's unauthorized. And if it's unauthorized, it was put there contrary to policies and subject to the DMCA. It'll be pulled down immediately once notice is provided. So I think, you know, they're the polar opposite examples, really.
We've had Hank Berry on the show, in fact, as our inaugural guest, and I think he probably would take issue with some of that characterization, at least some of it. But the one thing that does strike me as a similarity between the Napster scenario and the video sharing sites that we see today is the community aspect. I mean, Napster was perhaps the first social networking application, although it did not take a web-based form and instead, you know, introduce the world to the concept of peer-to-peer. It definitely had its community aspects that, grew up around a lot of copyrighted material, but a lot of independent material as well. And, there definitely was the component of Napster that involved exposing people to unsigned music that otherwise would not have gotten exposure. So I have a little trouble seeing the dramatic, absolute difference between not the things from a technological standpoint, but I guess from a functional standpoint.
Well, I mean, that was the argument of one of the founders of Napster, and then when her laptop was subpoenaed in litigation, she actually made the comment that Napster was about promoting bands, it wasn't about getting free copies of Madonna tunes. And then when her laptop was subpoenaed, there were 10 infringing Madonna tunes on her laptop. So there was a certain disingenuous element, I think, to some of the public statements that were made by the original founders of Napster. And then, later in its development, there were other companies or individuals who got involved trying to turn it into a more legitimate service.
But Ian, do you think that, if every case is, that would go to that kind of discovery where turning on, what files people had on their computer, that could be bad, for a DMCA defense. It just doesn't seem like that would make any sense. But when you talked about Grokster at the wonderful Stanford panel, it seemed like your view was that if there was any email or, in this case, infringing files, you just sort of had to hit a reset button and do a licensed business model. And I'm probably overly characterizing what you said, but it to me it's concerning because there isn't a perfect world, and it wouldn't seem that having a few infringing files or an email should be the turning point in a case.
Yeah, I mean I agree with that. I'm not sure what you mean by hit a reset button, and to be honest, I'm not sure which comment you're referring to from Stanford, but I certainly agree that one or two files here or there are not necessarily going to be indicative of different things. I think in that, the example that I gave, I think the public statements and private conduct of a particular individual showed that there was a certain disinformation campaign that at least she was involved in. But I agree. I mean, if there are some unauthorized files that a user has put on a service, that's really what the DMCA is all about. It's a mechanism for a copyright owner to notify the service provider about those files and to get them quickly removed.
I was noticing, Denise, that I looked at the the stipulation about the settlement. It's a conditional settlement based on getting this order that was made about the crime fraud production of privileged documents by the record labels overturned. I don't know if anyone has any thoughts on that. As you know, Ian, as a litigator, do you think that's a difficult thing to do?
I'm not really comfortable commenting on that particular order, to be honest.
Yeah, I noticed that too, Kathy, and thought, you know, it was a pretty interesting thing to present to the court, that you know, we'll be happy to make these claims go away if only you'll vacate your prior order. It'll be, as I said, interesting to see if that actually works.
Well, maybe Marty or John, do you guys have any thoughts on that?
Courts do it. I mean, they do. Settlements do vitiate prior decisions. So, I mean, there's some precedent in that sense. And one can't help but notice that it does create a huge red flag for future troublemakers to come along and see something that obviously disturbs these record companies.
Kathy, can you describe the order for us in a bit more detail in case someone listening is not familiar with it?
Sure. And it's a public court document. I think what it says is they entered into a conditional settlement agreement at the end of November, and I guess they need to go before the Ninth Circuit to ask it to vacate this order about this crime fraud exception. I guess there was a ruling that some documents that the record companies may have not been completely truthful with the Justice Department in connection with their earlier review of what they were doing in the online music space. And as a result, the court said that, well, then those documents may not be legally privileged. So I think it appears, gave the defendant some leverage here because that's what they want to have vacated. And I think, you know, from looking at it, that appears to be the status of the case right now.
That's right. So the court had made an adverse ruling in the Napster case, potentially adverse to the entertainment industry plaintiffs as far as potential antitrust claims against them about the way that they were structuring their own online download businesses. Do I pretty much have that?
Yeah, that's my understanding.
And then the other thing that struck me is there had been, and not just that order, but some other proceedings in the case that, you know, I mean, all these confidential settlements are just that, and we'll never know the actual details of how it came about or what it involves. But it looked as though there were some winds blowing evidentiarily in the case that were going against the plaintiffs and might have facilitated their willingness to get behind a settlement.
Denise, one other point we might pull out of this, just going to the earlier question of whether or not internet law is something other than the law of the horse, is I think one of the under-talked about aspects of internet among at least the internet law professor crowd is the impact on the discovery process and the extent to which electronic discovery and the extent to which one can get the laptop of the founder of Napster or every email and every hard drive of every record executive really does change the scope of litigation and the nature of it in important ways. Some might say it's a difference of degree. I would argue it's a difference in kind. But the nature of litigation really has been affected by internet in this context, or at least digital technologies in this context.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. The entire discovery field is a completely different animal than when I got into practicing law, and I think probably most of you too.
Well, in terms of internet laws, like the law of the sea, I mean, Ian, do you have any thoughts on this Barrett v. Rosenthal case? Because that's a defamation case online, so it's clearly an internet case.
Yeah, I think that is a good example of where internet law is different, but that's, of course, by virtue of a federal statute. Congress in 1996, as part of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, created an exemption in Section 230C that protects interactive computer services and users for third-party defamatory material. And the California Supreme Court issued a ruling that was consistent with other courts in finding that that exemption applied when material was republished by individuals or by companies. The only interesting thing there is how long the Supreme Court held on to the decision, because it was pending for several years. And in California, there's a requirement that opinions issue within a set period of time from oral argument. So in order to give itself more time, the California Supreme Court waited a considerable amount of time before scheduling oral argument. But the decision, I thought, was entirely consistent with the overwhelming body of case law.
Would you say, just to sort of connect some of the dots, Ian, for listeners, that the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, which still stands, and the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, Section 512, the safe harbor on the intellectual property side, operate in parallel, or how would you compare those two?
Well, I think they're different in terms of the way they operate, but they're similar in terms of addressing what were the two greatest concerns of website owners and service providers in the mid-1990s, which was the potential risk of liability for defamation and the potential risk for secondary copyright liability. The Communications Decency Act provision creates an exemption, and it is almost self-executing. It's arguably self-executing for any defamation claim. And subpart 2 has a requirement that certain potentially additional exemptions may be available for any action taken in good faith. But it's
and by self-executing, you mean you don't have to do anything in order
right.
to avail yourself of it.
Right, right. And subpart 2 requires merely any action taken in good faith, which is also extremely broad. The DMCA requires copyright owners to send notifications to service providers and then require service providers to disable access to or remove material in response to substantially complying notifications in order to avail themselves of the liability limitation. And in that regard, it's not self-executing. If a copyright owner does not send a notification, then the service provider cannot be held liable. If the service provider ignores a substantially complying notification, then the service provider may have exposure. So in that sense, it's it requires more affirmative action. But in both cases, these provisions of law address what were the greatest concerns of website owners and service providers in the mid-1990s and what were perceived by Congress to threaten the development of e-commerce.
And just as a normative matter, do you think those provisions still ought to be in place given the changes in the online landscape over the last 10 years?
I think it's part of the fabric, and I think you have entire businesses that have built up dependent on them.
From a policy standpoint, I really like the Communications Decency Act, Section 230's emphasis, or at least as it has been interpreted by the courts, on encouraging people to police their sites and police the things that go up on the sites and still giving them immunity. You know, if there is something up there that they've seen and should have taken down, perhaps, or arguably, that they can still invoke the provision. And that's something that the DMCA has been at least characterized to perhaps function differently. I know a lot of folks who've looked at those provisions and said, if you are policing, then you are not entitled to invoke this safe harbor. Ian and I had a conversation about that at a conference we were at earlier this year, and you don't interpret the safe harbor that way, is that right?
Wait, are we talking about the DMCA safe harbor?
The DMCA one. I have talked with folks who think that those two provisions, and they are separate statutes, there's no reason why they wouldn't function differently, and you pointed out that they do in various ways. But one of the ways that folks have noticed they function differently or asserted they function differently is that you can police and monitor and edit and still avail yourself of the safe harbor of Section 230, but perhaps not so under the DMCA, that there is some law or intimation in the statute itself that suggests that the moment you are actively policing the site and not or the content and not turning a blind eye to it and just acting as a mere conduit, then you're not entitled to the exemption. And we talked about that briefly, and I think you disagreed. Could you expand on that?
Yeah, I don't think that the DMCA encourages service providers to take a blind eye to infringement. I think, in fact, if they do that, they risk exposure. I think the DMCA requires service providers to respond to notifications and respond in instances where they have knowledge of particular instances of infringement. But I think turning a blind eye is not a good socially responsible or indeed appropriate form of conduct.
And certainly not a good business decision after Rockster.
Right. I don't think the law is intended to encourage people to turn a blind eye.
So I don't know if you folks saw, but the LA Times had seized on the fact that when Congress goes back into session next month, and Congress, by the way, is an entity that has decided there is a unique body of internet law that bears at least its own subcommittee along with courts and IP, the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Courts, Intellectual Property, and the Internet. We'll have a new chairman starting in January, and that's Howard L. Berman of Los Angeles. And I was wondering if any of you, particularly Ian, since that's your home jurisdiction, have any thoughts on the changes that Howard Berman might bring to that committee.
Yeah, I try to stay away from political observations. I have enough trouble dealing in courts.
Well, Rafat Ali at Paid Content characterized the shift as involving more attention to updating music licensing and royalty schemes for the digital age. So that's something that people seem to think needs attention. I think I would agree with it. How about you folks?
Well, this is Kathy. You know, I think that it's important that we continue to try to rationalize the copyright law and all that, but that hopefully it's not just dominated by, one viewpoint. I think that over time, that when we talk about the entertainment and the technology sectors, it appears that, both are pretty engaged in terms of what the law should be. There were a number of bills just before Congress finished up, and I think there's the one that got to the president was about the Red Cross, so nothing really major in this session, but I think going forward it'll be interesting to see what gets advanced, because in the past when, say, a bill about inducement or whatever was advanced without engaging with all of the stakeholders, it really didn't lead to any fruitful progress. So hopefully we'll see an open and engaged process in terms of what people are putting forward.
Well, one of the ways that music licensing can be brought into the digital age, regardless of what the lawmakers choose to do, is through technologies that make licensing schemes available in an automated way. And one of the things I look at as a potential analogy for the music industry is what Flickr has done with Creative Commons licenses. Flickr is the online photo sharing site that was bought by Yahoo, and it has Creative Commons licensing, which is a whole suite of licenses that you can select from that still protect content in various ways but make it more freely usable depending on which license you select, and allows people who upload to Flickr to pick whatever license they might want for that particular work or for all of their works, and thus make them more part of the commons. And I'm wondering, particularly Ian, if you have any thoughts on how a site like MySpace, which is about to make music downloads available for purchase, if I'm not mistaken, and is home to literally millions of independent bands who use the site to promote themselves, if you think that a similar model might make a lot of sense.
You know, I've always found that the clients like me to not make public statements about suggested business development. I think I'll stay away from that one, except to observe that the phenomenon of promoting music on MySpace is really a very interesting one, and I've observed just from my own use of the site how individual bands can directly contact users and get people excited about shows. And you know, I've been to at least one show where fully two-thirds of the people in the audience were people contacted on MySpace, and it's an amazing way to promote music.
Denise, this is John. I might just say, it seems to me that there's very little reason why any service provider would not want to make it easy for people to license their user-generated content or sort of semi-professionally generated content in the form of bands or fully professionally created content under a variety of license schemes, and the Creative Commons is an obvious and easy way to do that. Microsoft in the last year has embedded Creative Commons within every Word document, so with a very simple add-on or plug-in, you can add a CC license to any document of that sort. Obviously, many of the blogging softwares do this, Flickr and so forth, and I think one of the reasons why Creative Commons is 4 years old this weekend, after having been born at the Berkman Center several years ago and is now a hugely thriving organization, is that it does make business sense to offer the type of flexibility that those licenses afford, as well as allowing people to reserve full copyright if they want to.
Kathy, can you think of any reason why a licensing scenario might work for photographers but might not work in the unique world of the music industry?
Well, perhaps in music there are more rights to clear insofar as you have the recording that was recording and then there's the underlying song. So it's important for the person who's using it to make sure they have the necessary rights, to the elements that they put in. But setting that aside, essentially there isn't a difference. Creative Commons licenses is just a toolkit of different types of licenses where a user can decide, yes, this one suits me, this one doesn't, or that none of them do. And it's just another option out there for people to consider.
Another thing that I've noticed recently and thought was an interesting and potentially dangerous and or expensive development from the user standpoint anyway is the fact that Universal has convinced Microsoft to start paying it on a per unit basis for its Zune players, which apparently in order to get all the licensing that they needed to put as much material as they wanted to in the online download store associated with the Zune, they're actually paying $1 a unit to Universal Music Group for the potential infringements that might occur through lots of people owning this device. If you can readily see how that kind of logic could wind up costing the world a whole lot of money, and maybe that's one reason why we do need to look at new licensing scenarios and royalty scenarios, certainly in the digital age. Do you have any thoughts on this per unit charge? How about you, Ian?
As I say, I like to stay away from business and politics hard enough to help clients on the law.
This is John. I just want to say that, I think that there's a lot to unpack with the Zune story. Clearly, the example you note is one, and I guess I'm not sort of close enough to the kinds of business models that Microsoft and others would have had to be considering there, other than to say, I think that Tom Rubin, who's the chief copyright and trade secret and trademark lawyer at Microsoft, who came to our class right before the thing was put out, has done some very interesting things in terms of what you can do with a song and the, I think, unfortunately named squirting of a song from one player to another and so forth. And I think that with a package like Zune, you have some very interesting and I think creative lawyering, along with some last-minute business deals that are cut in order to get the thing out the door. And so I think it's important to look at the creative side as well as what people have characterized as potentially not a great sign last-minute business deal as well.
Who's going to be the first plaintiff to sue Microsoft, do you think, over the stripping out or the misuse of Creative Commons licensed material when something is squirted, i.e. the DRM that gets added to the file. You think it'll be a while that someone will actually decide to challenge that?
It's an intriguing question. I don't know. I mean, I think one thing that's interesting about Creative Commons licenses in this regard is, I've mentioned this before, but we at the Berkman Center have issued our first kind of threatening letter outbound for people who have misused things that were Creative Commons licensed. And I think it's actually really important to the support of the Creative Commons systems that, in fact, when somebody does violate the terms of the license, that you go after them in the same way as you might when somebody has, in fact, violated something that's in full copyright in order to sort of hold up the integrity of the system.
Yeah, I think with respect to podcasts, that gets very interesting. You know, this one, for example, goes out under a Creative Commons license. And if someone were to add DRM to it, that would, thwart the business model that this network has decided to employ, which is to more freely distribute its works. So I can definitely see that coming to a head soon.
One thing that I think is interesting about the Zoom thing that I haven't heard much discussion on is that it feels to me, although I'm not aware of any circumstances with this, that in the backdrop is the Audio Home Recording Act, which provides, a per device royalty. So it almost seems as, even though they're not subject to that perhaps, that was viewed as a potential boundary or precedent, because that provides for royalties, I think, between $1 and $8 or $10 per device. And then we had the Rio case that said, MP3 players are not subject to that. But I found it interesting that perhaps that's a backdrop where content owners are saying, no, I still like that concept, and I would like to go after that, even if technically the law says that, I'm not entitled to it.
So I promised you all, we're recording this right in the height of the holidays, the start of Hanukkah today, that we'd wrap up in an hour, and we're just coming in to our deadline there. So I'd love to go around and just check in with each of you before we go and find out what you're up to and what you will be up to in the near future, and see if there's anything else you'd like to share with the readers. Kathy, I particularly wanted to find out how your conference in New York went.
Oh, it was terrific. Thanks to people like Marty who participated. So had a lot of fun with that. I did wanted to just follow up on the talk about defamation, just to note that there was a paper at the Berkman Center by Glenn Reynolds about how defamation really isn't that, let's say, big a deal on the internet. And I think that's an interesting pointer for people. Also, I believe his name is Ken Myers, who was also at Berkman at one point when he was a law student, has written a wonderful paper about it. So if you Google him, you can find his paper. I just want to recommend that.
The conference I referred to was the Blog Law and Blogging for Lawyers conference, and it's the blog law part of it, I think, that is the most intriguing to me, because once again, I mean, if there's a separate body of internet law, if we, grant that, or that there, might at least be a reason to view it through that lens, then there's an even further separate body of law that relates to things like blogging and podcasting, and so I'm glad you're paying attention to that with your conference. And do you know if anybody blogged it? Is there a place where people can look for information online?
Let me send you a link. And what I guess I would say is I should have picked up on that, because it was very interesting that in terms of all the topics that you sort of bring together, they definitely have their non-blog aspects. But I think doing it in New York had a different sort of feel than when we did it in Silicon Valley, because it was very much we had some representatives of, say, media incumbents, and so there was a clear sense of sort of how do we protect the existing business, how do we deal with liabilities, and I felt that was a different approach than what we see out here in Silicon Valley every day. So it was really interesting to cross-pollinate and get different viewpoints.
Great. If you send me something, I'll be sure and get that in the show notes.
Thank you.
John, what's going on with you lately and what's coming up?
You're nice to ask. It's the last week of classes. I've got a student waiting outside my door, so I should go. But all is well. And I wanted to say that Ken Meyer's paper, which is in the Harvard Journal on Law and Technology, is great, and it's really focused on the example of Wikipedia and the Section 230 clause that we were talking about in CDA, and definitely commend that to everyone.
Great. If you could send me the link to that, I'll put that in the show notes too.
For sure.
And Ian, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show. I hope we have the opportunity to do so again. Have you been working on anything that you think might interest our readers and is not covered by the blanket of attorney-client privilege and or work product?
Well, you know, I've been working on a lot of interesting different internet-related things. And the one thing that I can say as a litigator is usually things tend to quiet down around the holidays. So I'm hoping to have a somewhat quiet holiday season and wait for things to get a little bit more active again in early January. So hopefully if we can get through the next week, things should be nice and quiet.
Great. Well, for anyone who is interested in the fine-grained details and the very, very convoluted world of case law and statutory law that has grown up around the internet and e-commerce. By the way, Ian, do you use that term a whole lot these days, e-commerce? Do your clients use that term?
I tend to use the term computer law, which was very popular back in the pre-internet days, because I think I do talk about internet law. I think Kathy's right there. It certainly is blog law. But in a way, all of this is really technology law or computer law. And I think it's important, getting back to the comment about Judge Posner, just to not get so hung up on the term du jour, when really, to a large extent, what we're dealing with is just law.
Right. Well, in any event, you have literally written the book on the subject, and I commend you for it. It's very useful. We'll be sure to get that in the show notes, too. It is.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you.
It is rather a pricey purchase, but it's a nice thing to have around. I know I totally monopolized my firm's set of the volumes when I had access to them. So it was definitely a resource I turned to again and again. Thanks so much to all of you for being on the show. And
thanks
to all the listeners for joining us again on This Week in Law. We'll see you next time.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye. Okay. Thank you.